only by his look. At the Barrière du Trône, they met Bertuccio, who was waiting there motionless as a sentinel at his post. Monte Cristo put his head out of the window, exchanged a few words with him in a low tone, and the steward disappeared. "Monsieur le Comte," said Emmanuel, when they were at the end of the Place Royale, "put me down at my door, that my wife may not have a single moment of needless anxiety on my account or yours. If it were not ridiculous to make a display of our triumph, I would invite the Count to our house. Besides that, he doubtless has some trembling heart to comfort. So we will take leave of our friend, and let him hasten him home." "Stop a moment," said Monte Cristo. "Do not let me lose both my companions. Return, Emmanuel, to your charming wife, and present my best compliments to her. And do you, Morel, accompany me to the Champs-Élysées." "Willingly," said Maximilian, "particularly as I have business in that quarter." "Shall we wait breakfast for you?" asked Emmanuel. "No," replied the young man. The door was closed, and the carriage proceeded. "See what good fortune I brought you," said Morel, when he was alone with the Count. "Have you not thought so?" "Yes," said Monte Cristo. "For that reason I wish to keep you near me." "It is miraculous," continued Morel, answering his own thoughts. "What?" said Monte Cristo. "What has just happened?" "Yes," said the Count. "You are right, it is miraculous." "For Albert is brave," resumed Morel. "Very brave," said Monte Cristo. "I have seen him sleep with a sword suspended over his head." "And I know he has fought two duels," said Morel. "How can you reconcile that with his conduct this morning?" "All owing to your influence," replied Monte Cristo, smiling. "It is well for Albert. He is not in the army," said Morel. "Why?" "An apology on the ground?" said the young captain, shaking his head. "Come," said the Count mildly, "do not entertain the prejudices of ordinary men, Morel. Acknowledge, if Albert is brave, he cannot be a coward. He must then have had some reason for acting as he did this morning, and confess that his conduct is more heroic than otherwise." "Doubtless, doubtless," said Morel. "But I shall say, like the Spaniard, he has not been so brave today as he was yesterday." "You will breakfast with me, will you not, Morel?" said the Count, to turn the conversation. "No, I must leave you at 10 o'clock." "Your engagement was for breakfast, then," said the Count. Morel smiled and shook his head. "Still, you must breakfast somewhere." "But if I am not hungry?" said the young man. "Oh," said the Count, "I only know two things which destroy the appetite. Grief, and as I am happy to see you very cheerful, it is not that, and love. Now, after what you told me this morning of your heart, I may believe..." "Well, Count," replied Morel gaily, "I will not dispute it." "But you will not make me your confidant, Maximilian," said the Count, in a tone which showed how gladly he would have been admitted to the secret. "I showed you this morning I had a heart, did I not, Count?" Monte Cristo only answered by extending his hand to the young man. "Well," continued the latter, "since that heart is no longer with you in the Bois de Vincennes, it is elsewhere, and I must go and find it." "Go," said the Count deliberately, "go, dear friend. But promise me, if you meet with any obstacle, to remember that I have some power in this world, that I am happy to use that power in the behalf of those I love, and that I love you, Morel." "I will remember it," said the young man, "as selfish children recollect their parents when they want their aid. When I need your assistance, and the moment may come, I will come to you, Count. Well, I rely upon your promise. Farewell. Adieu, till we meet again." They had arrived in the Champs-Élysées. Monte Cristo opened the carriage door. Morel sprang out on the pavement. Bertuccio was waiting on the steps. Morel disappeared through the avenue of Marigny, and Monte Cristo hastened to join Bertuccio. "Well?" asked he. "She is going to leave her house," said the steward. "And her son, Florentin, his valet, thinks he is going to do the same. Come this way." Monte Cristo took Bertuccio into his cabinet, wrote the letter we have seen, and gave it to the steward. "Go," said he quickly. "Apropos, let Ade be informed I have returned." "Here I am," said the young girl, who, at the sound of the carriage, had run downstairs, and whose face was radiant with joy at seeing the Count return safely. Bertuccio left. Every transport of a daughter finding a father, all the delight of a mistress seeing an adored lover, were felt by Ade during the first moments of this meeting which he had so eagerly expected. Doubtless, although less evident, Monte Cristo's joy was not less intense. Joy to hearts which have suffered long is like the dew on the ground after a long drought. Both the heart and the ground absorb that beneficent moisture falling on them, and nothing is outwardly apparent. Monte Cristo was beginning to think what he had not for a long time dared to believe, that there were two Mercedes in the world, and he might yet be happy. His eye, elate with happiness, was reading eagerly the moistened gaze of Ade, when suddenly the door opened. The Count knit his brow. "Monsieur de Morcerf," said Baptistin, as if that name sufficed for his excuse. In fact, the Count's face brightened. "Which," asked he, "the Viscount or the Count?" "The Count."
"Oh," exclaimed Ade, "is it not yet over?"
"I know not if it is finished, my beloved child," said Monte Cristo, taking the young girl's hands. "But I do know you have nothing more to fear."
"But it is the wretched that man cannot injure me, Ade," said Monte Cristo.
"It was his son alone there was cause to fear."
"And what I have suffered," said the young girl, "you shall never know, my lord."
Monte Cristo smiled. "By my father's tomb," said he, extending his hand over the head of the young girl, "I swear to you, Ade, that if any misfortune happens, it will not be to me."
"I believe you, my lord, as implicitly as if God had spoken to me," said the young girl, presenting her forehead to him.
Monte Cristo pressed on that pure, beautiful forehead a kiss which made two hearts throb at once, the one violently, the other secretly. "Oh," murmured the Count, "shall I then be permitted to love again?" "Ask Monsieur de Morcerf into the drawing-room," said he to Baptistin, while he led the beautiful Greek girl to a private staircase. We must explain this visit, which, although Monte Cristo expected, is unexpected to our readers. While Mercedes, as we have said, was making a similar inventory of her property to Albert's, while she was arranging her jewels, shutting her drawers, collecting her keys, to leave everything in perfect order, she did not perceive a pale and sinister face at a glass door which threw light into the passage, from which everything could be both seen and heard. He who was thus looking without being heard or seen probably heard and saw all that passed in Madame de Morcerf's apartments. From that glass door the pale-faced man went to the Count's bedroom and raised the curtain of a window overlooking the courtyard. He remained there 10 minutes, motionless and dumb, listening to the beating of his own heart. For him those 10 minutes were very long. It was then Albert returned from his rendezvous, perceived his father watching for his arrival behind a curtain, and turned aside. The Count's eye expanded. He knew Albert had insulted the Count dreadfully, and that in every country in the world such an insult would lead to a deadly duel. Albert returned safely. Then the Count was revenged. An indescribable ray of joy illumined that wretched countenance, like the last ray of the sun before it disappears behind a mass of clouds which appear more like its tomb than its couch. But, as we have said, he waited in vain for his son to come to his apartment with the account of his triumph.
He easily understood why his son did not come to see him before he went to avenge his father's honour. But when that was done, why did not his son come and throw himself in his arms? Then it was that the count, being unable to see Albert, sent for his servant. It was known that he was authorized to conceal nothing from the count. 10 minutes afterwards, General Morcerf was seen on the steps in a black coat with a military collar, black pantaloons, and black gloves. He had apparently given previous orders, for as he reached the bottom step, his carriage came from the coach-house ready for him. The valet threw into the carriage his military cloak, in which two swords were wrapped, and shutting the door, he took his seat by the side of the coachman. The coachman stooped down for his orders. "To the Champs-Élysées," said the general, "the Count of Monte Cristo's. Hurry." The horses bounded beneath the whip, and in 5 minutes they stopped before the count's door. Monsieur de Morcerf opened the door himself, and as the carriage rolled away, he passed up the walk, rang, and entered the open door with his servant. A moment afterwards, Battistin announced the Comte de Morcerf to Monsieur de Monte Cristo, and the latter, leading Aide aside, ordered the Comte de Morcerf to be asked into the drawing-room. The general was pacing the room the third time, when, in turning, he perceived Monte Cristo at the door.
"Hey, it is Monsieur de Morcerf," said Monte Cristo quietly. "I thought I had heard wrong." "Yes, it is I," said the count, whom a frightful contraction of the lips prevented from articulating freely. "May I know the cause which procures me the pleasure of seeing Monsieur de Morcerf so early? Had you not a meeting with my son this morning?" asked the general.
"I had," replied the count,
"and I know my son had good reasons to wish to fight with you and to endeavour to kill you."
"Yes, sir, he had very good ones. But you see, in spite of them, he has not killed me, and did not even fight.
Yet he considered you the cause of his father's dishonour, the cause of the fearful ruin which has fallen on my house."
"Truly, sir," said Monte Cristo with his dreadful calmness, "a secondary cause, but not the principal.
Doubtless you made then some apology or explanation?"
"I explained nothing, and it is he who apologized to me.
But to what do you attribute this conduct? To the conviction, probably, that there was one more guilty than me."
"And who was that?"
"His father."
"That may be," said the count, turning pale. "But, you know, the guilty do not like to find themselves convicted."
"I know it."
"And I expected this result."
"You expected my son would be a coward?" cried the count.
"Monsieur Albert de Morcerf is no coward," said Monte Cristo.
"A man who holds a sword in his hand and sees a mortal enemy within reach of that sword and does not fight is a coward. Why is he not here that I may tell him so?"
"Sir," replied Monte Cristo coldly, "I did not expect you had come here to relate to me your little family affairs. Go and tell Monsieur Albert that, and he may know what to answer you."
"Oh, no. No," said the general, smiling faintly. "I did not come for that purpose. You are right. I came to tell you that I also look upon you as my enemy. I came to tell you that I hate you instinctively, that it seems as if I had always known you and always hated you. And in short, since the young people of the present day will not fight, it remains for us to do it. Do you think so, sir?"
"Certainly."
"And when I told you I had foreseen the result, it is the honour of your visit I alluded to. So much the better. Are you prepared?"
"Yes, sir."
"You know that we shall fight till one of us is dead," said the general, whose teeth were clenched with rage, "until one of us dies.
repeated Monte Cristo, moving his head slightly up and down. Let us start, then. We need no witnesses.
Truly, said Monte Cristo, it is unnecessary. We know each other so well.
On the contrary, said the Count, we know so little of each other.
Indeed, said Monte Cristo, with the same indomitable coolness. Let us see. Are you not the soldier Fernand, who deserted on the eve of the Battle of Waterloo? Are you not the Lieutenant Fernand, who served as guide and spy to the French army in Spain? Are you not the Captain Fernand who betrayed, sold, and murdered his benefactor Ali? And have not all these Fernands united made the Lieutenant General, the Count of Morcerf, peer of France?
Oh, cried the general, as if branded with a hot iron, wretch, to reproach me with my shame, when about perhaps to kill me. No, I did not say I was a stranger to you. I know well, demon, that you have penetrated into the darkness of the past, and that you have read by the light of what flambeau I know not every page of my life. But perhaps I may be more honorable in my shame than you under your pompous coverings. No, no, I am aware you know me, but I know you not, adventurer, sewn up in gold and jewelry. You have called yourself at Paris the Count of Monte Cristo, in Italy Sinbad the Sailor, in Malta I forget what. But it is your real name I want to know, in the midst of your hundred names, that I may pronounce it when we meet to fight, at the moment when I plunge my sword through your heart.
The Count of Monte Cristo turned dreadfully pale. His eye seemed to burn with a devouring fire. He bounded towards a dressing room near his bedroom, and in less than a moment, tearing off his cravat, his coat and waistcoat, he put on a sailor's jacket and hat, from beneath which rolled his long black hair. He returned thus, formidable and implacable, advancing with his arms crossed on his breast towards the general, who could not understand why he had disappeared, but who, on seeing him again and feeling his teeth chatter and his legs sink under him, drew back, and only stopped when he found a table to support his clenched hand.
"Fernand," cried he, "of my hundred names, I need only tell you one to overwhelm you. But you guess it now, do you not? Or rather, you remember it. For notwithstanding all my sorrows and my tortures, I show you today a face which the happiness of revenge makes young again, a face you must often have seen in your dreams since your marriage with Mercedes, my betrothed."
The general, with his head thrown back, hands extended, gaze fixed, looked silently at this dreadful apparition. Then, seeking the wall to support him, he glided along close to it until he reached the door, through which he went out backwards, uttering this single, mournful, lamentable, distressing cry.
"Edmund Dantès!"
Then, with sighs which were unlike any human sound, he dragged himself to the door, reeled across the courtyard, and falling into the arms of his valet, he said in a voice scarcely intelligible,
"Home! Home!"
The fresh air and the shame he felt at having exposed himself before his servants partially recalled his senses. But the ride was short, and as he drew near his house, all his wretchedness revived. He stopped at a short distance from the house and alighted. The door of the hotel was wide open. A hackney coach was standing in the middle of the yard, a strange sight before so noble a mansion. The Count looked at it with terror, but without daring to ask, he rushed towards his apartment. Two persons were coming down the stairs. He had only time to creep into a cabinet to avoid them. It was Mercedes leaning on her son's arm and leaving the hotel. They passed close by the unhappy being, who, concealed behind the damask door, almost felt Mercedes' dress brush past him and his son's warm breath pronouncing these words,
"Courage, my mother. Come, this is no longer our home."
The words died away. The steps were lost in the distance. The general drew himself up, clinging to the door. He uttered the most dreadful sob which ever escaped from the bosom of a father abandoned at the same time by his wife and son. He soon heard the clatter of the iron step of the hackney coach, then the coachman's voice, and then the rolling of the heavy vehicle shook the windows. He darted to his bedroom to see once more all he had loved in the world. But the hackney coach drove on, without the head of either Mercedes or her son appearing at the window to take a last look at the house or the deserted father or husband. And at the very moment when the wheels of that coach crossed the gateway, a report was heard, and a thick smoke escaped through one of the panes of the window, which was broken by the explosion. 94. Valentine. We may easily conceive where Morel's appointment was. On leaving Monte Cristo, he walked slowly toward Villefort's. We say slowly, for Morel had more than half an hour to spare to go 500 steps, but he had hastened to take leave of Monte Cristo because he wished to be alone with his thoughts. He knew his time well, the hour when Valentine was giving Noirtier his breakfast, and was sure not to be disturbed in the performance of this pious duty. Noirtier and Valentine had given him leave to go twice a week, and he was now availing himself of that permission. He arrived. Valentine was expecting him. Uneasy and almost wondering, she seized his hand and led him to her grandfather. This uneasiness, amounting almost to wildness, arose from the report Morcerf's adventure had made in the world. The affair of the opera was generally known. No one at Villefort's doubted that a duel would ensue from it. Valentine, with her woman's instinct, guessed that Morel would be Monte Cristo's witness, and from the young man's well-known courage and his great affection for the Count, she feared he would not content himself with the passive part assigned to him. We may easily understand how eagerly the particulars were asked for, given, and received, and Morel could read an indescribable joy in the eyes of his beloved when she knew that the termination of this affair was as happy as it was unexpected. "Now," said Valentine, motioning to Morel to sit down near her grandfather while she took her seat on his footstool, "now let us talk about our own affairs. You know, Maximilian, Grandpapa once thought of leaving this house and taking an apartment away from Monsieur de Villefort's." "Yes," said Maximilian, "I recollect this project, of which I highly approved." "Well," said Valentine, "you may approve again, for Grandpapa is again thinking of it." "Bravo," said Maximilian. "And do you know," said Valentine, "what reason Grandpapa gives for leaving this house?" Noirtier looked at Valentine to impose silence, but she did not notice him. Her looks, her eyes, her smile were all for Morel. "Oh, whatever may be Monsieur Noirtier's reason," answered Morel, "I will readily believe it to be a good one." "An excellent one," said Valentine. "He pretends the air of the Faubourg Saint-Honoré is not good for me." "Indeed," said Morel. "In that Monsieur Noirtier may be right. Your health has not appeared good the last fortnight." "Not very," said Valentine, "and Grandpapa is become my physician, and I have the greatest confidence in him because he knows everything." "Do you then really suffer?" asked Morel quickly. "Oh, it must not be called suffering. I feel a general uneasiness, that is all. I have lost my appetite, and my stomach feels to be struggling to become accustomed to something." Noirtier did not lose a word of what Valentine said. "And what treatment do you adopt for this singular complaint?" "A very simple one," said Valentine. "I swallow every morning a spoonful of the mixture prepared for my grandfather. When I say one spoonful, I began by one. Now I take four. Grandpapa says it is a panacea." Valentine smiled, but it was evident she suffered. Maximilian, in his devotedness, gazed silently at her.
She was very beautiful, but her usual paleness had increased. Her eyes were more brilliant than ever, and her hands, which were generally white like mother-of-pearl, now more resembled wax, to which time was adding a yellowish hue. From Valentine, the young man looked towards Moitier. The latter watched with strange and deep interest the young girl absorbed by her affection, and he also, like Morel, following those traces of inward suffering which were so little perceptible to a common observer, they escaped the notice of everyone but the grandfather and the lover.
"But," said Morel, "I thought this mixture, of which you now take 4 spoonfuls, was prepared for Monsieur Noirtier. I know it is very bitter," said Valentine, "so bitter that all I drink afterwards appears to have the same taste."
Noirtier looked inquiringly at his granddaughter.
"Yes, Grandpapa," said Valentine, "it is so. Just now, before I came down to you, I drank a glass of Eau Sucrée. I left half because it seemed so bitter."
Noirtier turned pale and made a sign that he wished to speak. Valentine rose to fetch the dictionary. Noirtier watched her with evident anguish. In fact, the blood was rushing to the young girl's head already. Her cheeks were becoming red.
"Oh," cried she, without losing any of her cheerfulness, "this is singular. A dimness. Did the sun shine in my eyes?"
And she leaned against the window. "The sun is not shining," said Morel, more alarmed by Noirtier's expression than by Valentine's indisposition. He ran towards her. The young girl smiled.
"Comfort yourself," said she to Noirtier. "Do not be alarmed, Maximilian. It is nothing and has already passed away. But listen, do I not hear a carriage in the courtyard?"
She opened Noirtier's door, ran to a window in the passage, and returned hastily.
"Yes," said she, "it is Madame Danglars and her daughter who are come to call on us. Goodbye. I must run away, for they would send here for me. Or rather, farewell till I see you again. Stay with Grandpapa, Maximilian. I promise you not to persuade them to stay."
Morel watched her as she left the room. He heard her ascend the little staircase which led both to Madame de Villefort's apartments and to hers. As soon as she was gone, Noirtier made a sign to Morel to take the dictionary. Morel obeyed. Guided by Valentine, he had learned how to understand the old man quickly. Accustomed, however, as he was, and having to repeat most of the letters of the alphabet, and to find every word in the dictionary, it was 10 minutes before the thought of the old man was translated by these words. "Fetch the glass of water and the decanter from Valentine's room." Morel rang immediately for the servant who had taken Barrois's situation, and in Noirtier's name gave that order. The servant soon returned. The decanter and the glass were completely empty. Noirtier made a sign that he wished to speak. "Why are the glass and decanter empty?" asked he. "Valentine said she only drank half the glassful." The translation of this new question occupied another 5 minutes.
"I do not know," said the servant, "but the housemaid is in Mademoiselle Valentine's room. Perhaps she has emptied them."
"Ask her," said Morel, translating Noirtier's thought this time by his look. The servant went out, but returned almost immediately.
"Mademoiselle Valentine passed through the room to go to Madame de Villefort's," said he, "and in passing, as she was thirsty, she drank what remained in the glass. As for the decanter, Master Edouard had emptied that to make a pond for his ducks."
Noirtier raised his eyes to heaven, as a gambler does who stakes his all on one stroke. From that moment, the old man's eyes were fixed on the door and did not quit it. It was indeed Madame Danglars and her daughter whom Valentine had seen. They had been ushered into Madame de Villefort's room, who had said she would receive them there. That is why Valentine passed through her room, which was on a level with Valentine's, and only separated from it by Edouard's. The two ladies entered the drawing-room with that sort of official stiffness which announced a communication. Between worldly people a shadow is soon caught. Madame de Villefort received them with equal solemnity. Valentine entered at this moment, and the formalities were resumed.
"My dear friend," said the Countess, while the two young people were shaking hands, "I and Eugenie are come to be the first to announce to you the approaching marriage of my daughter with Prince Cavalcanti."
Danglars kept up the title of Prince. The popular banker found it answered better than Count.
"Allow me to present you my sincere congratulations," replied Madame de Villefort. "Monsieur le Prince Cavalcanti appears a young man of rare qualities." "Listen," said the Countess, smiling. "Speaking to you as a friend, I would say the prince does not yet appear all he will be. He has about him a little of that foreign manner by which French persons recognize at first sight the Italian or German nobleman. Besides, he gives evidence of great kindness of disposition, much keenness of wit, and, as to suitableness, Monsieur Danglars assures me his fortune is majestic. That is his term."
"And then," said Eugenie, while turning over the leaves of Madame de Villefort's album, "add that you have taken a great fancy to the young man."
"And," said Madame de Villefort, "I need not ask you if you share that fancy."
"I," replied Eugenie, with her usual candor.
"Oh, not the least in the world, madame. My wish was not to confine myself to domestic cares or the caprices of any man, but to be an artist, and consequently free in heart, in person, and in thought."
Eugenie pronounced these words with so firm a tone that the color mounted to Valentine's cheeks. The timid girl could not understand that vigorous nature which appeared to have none of the timidities of woman.
"At any rate," said she, "since I am to be married, whether I will or not, I ought to be thankful to Providence for having released me from my engagement with Monsieur Albert de Morcerf, or I should this day have been the wife of a dishonored man."
"It is true," said the Countess, with that strange simplicity sometimes met with among fashionable ladies, and of which plebeian intercourse can never entirely deprive them.
"It is very true that, had not the Morcerfs hesitated, my daughter would have married that Monsieur Albert. The general depended much on it. He even came to force Monsieur Danglars. We have had a narrow escape."
"But," said Valentine timidly, "does all the father's shame revert upon the son? Monsieur Albert appears to me quite innocent of the treason charged against the general."
"Excuse me," said the implacable young girl. "Monsieur Albert claims and well deserves his share. It appears that after having challenged Monsieur de Monte Cristo at the opera yesterday, he apologized on the ground today."
"Impossible," said Madame de Villefort.
"Ah, my dear friend," said Madame Danglars with the same simplicity we before noticed, "it is a fact. I heard it from Monsieur Debray, who was present at the explanation."
Valentine also knew the truth, but she did not answer. Deeply engaged with a sort of inward contemplation, she had ceased for a moment to join in the conversation. She would, indeed, have found it impossible to repeat what had been said during the last few minutes, when suddenly Madame Danglars' hand pressed on her arm aroused her from her dream.
"What is it?" said she, starting at Madame Danglars' touch as she would have done from an electric shock. "It is, my dear Valentine," said the Baroness, "that you are doubtless suffering."
"I?" said the young girl, passing her hand across her burning forehead.
"Yes. Look at yourself in that glass. You have turned pale and red successively 3 or 4 times in 1 minute."
"Indeed," cried Eugenie, "you are very pale."
"Oh, do not be alarmed. I have been so for some days."
Artless as she was, the young girl knew this was an opportunity to leave. Besides, Madame de Villefort came to her assistance. "Retire, Valentine," said she. "You are really suffering, and these ladies will excuse you. Drink a glass of pure water. It will restore you."
Valentine kissed Eugénie, bowed to Madame Danglars, who had already risen to take her leave, and went out.
"That poor child," said Madame de Villefort when Valentine was gone, "she makes me very uneasy, and I should not be astonished if she had some serious illness."
Meanwhile, Valentine, in a sort of excitement which she could not quite understand, had crossed Edouard's room without noticing some naughtiness or other of the child, and through her own had reached the little staircase. She was at the bottom, excepting three steps. She already heard Morel's voice, when suddenly a cloud passed over her eyes. Her stiffened foot missed the step. Her hands had no power to hold the baluster, and, falling against the wall, she rolled down these three steps rather than walked. Morel bounded to the door, opened it, and found Valentine extended on the floor. Rapid as lightning, he raised her in his arms and placed her in a chair. Valentine opened her eyes.
"Oh, what a clumsy thing I am," said she with feverish volubility. "I no longer know my way. I forgot there were three more steps before the landing."
"You have hurt yourself, perhaps," said Morel. "What can I do for you, Valentine?" Valentine looked round her. She saw the deepest terror depicted in Noirtier's eyes.
"Comfort yourself, dear grandpapa," said she, endeavouring to smile. "It is nothing. It is nothing. I was giddy, that is all."
"Another giddiness," said Morel, clasping his hands. "Oh, attend to it, Valentine, I entreat you."
"But no," said Valentine. "No, I tell you, it is all past, and it was nothing. Now, let me tell you some news. Eugénie is to be married in a week, and in 3 days there is to be a grand feast, a sort of betrothing festival. We are all invited, my father, Madame de Villefort, and I. At least I understood it so."
"When will it then be our turn to think of these things? Oh, Valentine, you who have so much influence over your grandpapa, try to make him answer soon."
"And do you?" said Valentine. "Depend on me to stimulate the tardiness and arouse the memory of grandpapa?"
"Yes," cried Morel.
"Be quick. So long as you are not mine, Valentine, I shall always think I may lose you."
"Oh," cried Valentine with a convulsive movement.
"Oh, indeed, Maximilian. You are too timid for an officer, for a soldier who, they say, never knows fear. Ah, ah, ah."
She burst into a forced and melancholy laugh. Her arms stiffened and twisted, her head fell back on her chair, and she remained motionless. The cry of terror which was stopped on Noirtier's lips seemed to start from his eyes. Morel understood it. He knew he must call assistance. The young man rang the bell violently. The housemaid who had been in Mademoiselle Valentine's room and the servant who had replaced Barrois ran in at the same moment. Valentine was so pale, so cold, so inanimate that, without listening to what was said to them, they were seized with the fear which pervaded that house, and they flew into the passage crying for help. Madame Danglars and Eugénie were going out at that moment. They heard the cause of the disturbance.
"I told you so," cried Madame de Villefort. "Poor child."
95. The Confession. At the same moment, Monsieur de Villefort's voice was heard calling from his cabinet.
"What is the matter?"
Morel consulted Noirtier's look, who had recovered his self-command, and with a glance indicated the closet where once before, under somewhat similar circumstances, he had taken refuge. He had only time to get his hat and throw himself breathless into the closet. The procureur's footstep was heard in the passage. Villefort sprang into the room, ran to Valentine, and took her in his arms.
"A physician! A physician! Monsieur d'Avrigny!" cried Villefort. "Or, rather, I will go for him myself."
He flew from the apartment, and Morel, at the same moment, darted out at the other door. He had been struck to the heart by a frightful recollection, the conversation he had heard between the doctor and Vifor the night of Madame de Saint-Marin's death recurred to him. These symptoms, to a less alarming extent, were the same which had preceded the death of Barrois. At the same time, Monte Cristo's voice seemed to resound in his ear, who had said, only 2 hours before, "Whatever you want, Morel, come to me. I have great power." More rapidly than thought, he darted down the Rue Matignon and thence to the Avenue de Champs-Élysées. Meanwhile, Monsieur de Vifor arrived in a hired cabriolet at Monsieur d'Avrigny's door. He rang so violently that the porter came alarmed. Vifor ran upstairs without saying a word. The porter knew him and let him pass, only calling to him, "In his cabinet, Monsieur le Procureur du Roi, in his cabinet." Vifor pushed, or rather forced, the door open. "Ah," said the doctor. "Is it you?" "Yes," said Vifor, closing the door after him. "It is I, who am come in my turn to ask you if we are quite alone. Doctor, my house is accursed."
"What?" said the latter, with apparent coolness but with deep emotion.
"Have you another invalid?"
"Yes, doctor,"
cried Vifor, seizing with a convulsive grasp a handful of hair.
"Yes."
D'Avrigny's look implied, "I told you it would be so." Then he slowly uttered these words, "Who is now dying in your house? What new victim is going to accuse you of weakness before God?" A mournful sob burst from Vifor's heart. He approached the doctor, and seizing his arm,
"Valentine," said he, "it is Valentine's turn."
"Your daughter?" cried D'Avrigny, with grief and surprise.
"You see, you were deceived," murmured the magistrate. "Come and see her, and on her bed of agony entreat her pardon for having suspected her."
"Each time you have applied to me," said the doctor, "it has been too late. Still, I will go. But let us make haste, sir. With the enemies you have to do with, there is no time to be lost."
"Oh, this time, doctor, you shall not have to reproach me with weakness. This time I will know the assassin, and will pursue him.
Let us try first to save the victim, before we think of revenging her," said D'Avrigny. "Come." The same cabriolet which had brought Vifor took them back at full speed, at the same moment when Morel rapped at Monte Cristo's door. The Count was in his cabinet and was reading, with an angry look, something which Bertuccio had brought in haste. Hearing Morel announced, who had left him only 2 hours before, the Count raised his head. He, as well as the Count, had evidently been much tried during these 2 hours, for he had left him smiling and returned with a disturbed air. The Count rose and sprang to meet him. "What is the matter, Maximilian?" asked he. "You are pale, and the perspiration rolls from your forehead." Morel fell rather than sat down on a chair.
"Yes," said he, "I came quickly. I wanted to speak to you."
"Is all your family well?" asked the Count, with an affectionate benevolence whose sincerity no one could for a moment doubt.
"Thank you, Count, thank you," said the young man, evidently embarrassed how to begin the conversation. "Yes, everyone in my family is well."
"So much the better." "Yet you have something to tell me," replied the Count, with increased anxiety.
"Yes," said Morel, "it is true. I have just left a house where death has just entered to run to you."
"Are you then come from Monsieur de Morcerf's?" asked Monte Cristo.
"No," said Morel. "Is someone dead in his house?"
"The general has just blown his brains out," replied Monte Cristo, with great coolness.
"Oh, what a dreadful event!" cried Maximilian.
"Not for the Countess, nor for Albert," said Monte Cristo. "A dead father or husband is better than a dishonored one. Blood washes out shame."
"Poor Countess," said Maximilian. "I pity her very much. She is so noble a woman."
"Pity Albert also, Maximilian. For, believe me, he is the worthy son of the Countess. But let us return to yourself. You have hastened to me.
Can I have the happiness of being useful to you?
Yes, I need your help. That is, I thought, like a madman, you could lend me your assistance in a case where God alone can succor me.
Tell me what it is, replied Monte Cristo.
Oh, said Morrel, I know not, indeed, if I may reveal this secret to mortal ears. But fatality impels me, necessity constrains me, Count.
Morrel hesitated. Do you think I love you? Said Monte Cristo, taking the young man's hand affectionately in his.
Oh, you encourage me, and something tells me there, placing his hand on his heart, that I ought to have no secret from you.
You are right, Morrel. God is speaking to your heart, and your heart speaks to you. Tell me what it says.
Count, will you allow me to send Battistan to inquire after someone you know?
I am at your service, and still more my servants.
Oh, I cannot live if she is not better.
Shall I ring for Battistan?
No, I will go and speak to him myself.
Morrel went out, called Battistan, and whispered a few words to him. The valet ran directly.
Well, have you sent? Asked Monte Cristo, seeing Morrel return.
Yes, and now I shall be more calm.
You know I am waiting, said Monte Cristo, smiling.
Yes, and I will tell you. One evening I was in a garden. A clump of trees concealed me. No one suspected I was there. Two persons passed near me. Allow me to conceal their names for the present. They were speaking in an undertone, and yet I was so interested in what they said that I did not lose a single word.
This is a gloomy introduction, if I may judge from your paleness and shuddering, Morrel.
Oh, yes, very gloomy, my friend. Someone had just died in the house to which that garden belonged. One of those persons whose conversation I overheard was the master of the house, the other the physician. The former was confiding to the latter his grief and fear, for it was the second time within a month that death had entered suddenly and unexpectedly that house, apparently destined to destruction by some exterminating angel as an object of God's anger.
Ah, ah, said Monte Cristo, looking earnestly at the young man, and by an imperceptible movement turning his chair so that he remained in the shade while the light fell full on Maximilian's face.
Yes, continued Morrel, death had entered that house twice within 1 month.
And what did the doctor answer? Said Monte Cristo.
He replied that the death was not a natural one, and must be attributed
to what?
To poison.
Indeed, said Monte Cristo with a slight cough, which in moments of extreme emotion helped him to disguise a blush or his paleness or the intense interest with which he listened.
Indeed, Maximilian, did you hear that?
Yes, my dear Count, I heard it. And the doctor added that if another death occurred in a similar way, he must appeal to justice.
Monte Cristo listened, or appeared to do so, with the greatest calmness.
Well, said Maximilian, death came a third time, and neither the master of the house nor the doctor said a word. Death is now perhaps striking a fourth blow.
Count, what am I bound to do, being in possession of this secret?
My dear friend, said Monte Cristo, you appear to be relating an adventure which we all know by heart. I know the house where you heard it, or one very similar to it. A house with a garden, a master, a physician, and where there have been three unexpected and sudden deaths.
Well, I have not intercepted your confidence, and yet I know all that as well as you, and I have no conscientious scruples.
No, it does not concern me.
You say an exterminating angel appears to have devoted that house to God's anger.
Well, who says your supposition is not reality?
Do not notice things which those whose interest it is to see them pass over.
If it is God's justice, instead of his anger, which is walking through that house, Maximilian, turn away your face, and let his justice accomplish its purpose.
Morrel shuddered, There was something mournful, solemn, and terrible in the Count's manner. Besides, continued he, in so changed a tone that no one would have supposed it was the same person speaking, besides, who says that it will begin again? It has returned, Count, exclaimed Morrel. That is why I hastened to you. Well, what do you wish me to do? Do you wish me, for instance, to give information to the Procureur du Roi? Monte Cristo uttered the last words with so much meaning that Morrel, starting up, cried out, You know of whom I speak, Count, do you not? Perfectly well, my good friend. And I will prove it to you by putting the dots to the I, or rather, by naming the persons. You were walking one evening in Monsieur de Villefort's garden. From what you relate, I suppose it to have been the evening of Madame de Saint Marin's death. You heard Monsieur de Villefort talking to Monsieur d'Avrigny about the death of Monsieur de Saint Marin, and that no less surprising of the Countess. Monsieur d'Avrigny said he believed they both proceeded from poison, and you, honest man, have ever since been asking your heart and sounding your conscience to know if you ought to expose or conceal this secret. Why do you torment them? Conscience, what hast thou to do with me, as Sterne said? My dear fellow, let them sleep on if they are asleep. Let them grow pale in their drowsiness if they are disposed to do so, and pray do you remain in peace who have no remorse to disturb you. Deep grief was depicted on Morel's features. He seized Monte Cristo's hand. But it is beginning again, I say. Well, said the Count, astonished at his perseverance, which he could not understand, and looking still more earnestly at Maximilian, let it begin again. It is a family of Atreides. God has condemned them, and they must submit to their punishment. They will all disappear, like the fabrics children build with cards, and which fall one by one under the breath of their builder, even if there are 200 of them. 3 months since it was Monsieur de Saint Marin. Madame de Saint Marin, 2 months since. The other day it was Barrois. Today the old Noirtier, or young Valentine. You knew it, cried Morrel, in such a paroxysm of terror that Monte Cristo started, he whom the falling heavens would have found unmoved. You knew it, and said nothing? And what is it to me? Replied Monte Cristo, shrugging his shoulders. Do I know those people? And must I lose the one to save the other? Faith, no, for between the culprit and the victim I have no choice. But I, cried Morrel, groaning with sorrow, I love her. You love? Whom? Cried Monte Cristo, starting on his feet and seizing the two hands which Morrel was raising towards heaven. I love most fondly. I love madly. I love as a man who would give his life-blood to spare her a tear. I love Valentine de Villefort, who is being murdered at this moment. Do you understand me? I love her, and I ask God and you how I can save her. Monte Cristo uttered a cry, which those only can conceive who have heard the roar of a wounded lion. Unhappy man, cried he, wringing his hands in his turn. You love Valentine, that daughter of an accursed race? Never had Morrel witnessed such an expression. Never had so terrible an eye flashed before his face. Never had the genius of terror he had so often seen, either on the battlefield or in the murderous nights of Algeria, shaken around him more dreadful fires. He drew back, terrified. As for Monte Cristo, after this ebullition, he closed his eyes as if dazzled by internal light. In a moment he restrained himself so powerfully that the tempestuous heaving of his breast subsided, as turbulent and foaming waves yield to the sun's genial influence when the cloud has passed. This silence, self-control, and struggle lasted about 20 seconds. Then the Count raised his pallid face. See, said he, my dear friend, how God punishes the most thoughtless and unfeeling men for their indifference by presenting dreadful scenes to their view. I, who was looking on, an eager and curious spectator, I, who was watching the working of this mournful tragedy, I, who, like a wicked angel, was laughing at the evil men committed, protected by secrecy. A secret is easily kept by the rich and powerful. I am, in my turn, bitten by the serpent whose tortuous course I was watching, and bitten to the heart. Morrel groaned.
Come, come, continued the Count. Complaints are unavailing. Be a man, be strong, be full of hope, for I am here and will watch over you. Morrel shook his head sorrowfully. I tell you to hope. Do you understand me? Cried Monte Cristo. Remember that I never utter a falsehood and am never deceived. It is 12 o'clock, Maximilian. Thank heaven that you came at noon, rather than in the evening or tomorrow morning. Listen, Morrel. It is noon. If Valentine is not now dead, she will not die.
How so? Cried Morrel. When I left her dying.
Monte Cristo pressed his hand to his forehead. What was passing in that brain, so loaded with dreadful secrets? What does the angel of light or the angel of darkness say to that mind at once implacable and generous? God only knows. Monte Cristo raised his head once more, and this time he was calm as a child awaking from its sleep. Maximilian, said he, return home. I command you not to stir. Attempt nothing. Not to let your countenance betray a thought, and I will send you tidings. Go. Oh, Count, you overwhelm me with that coolness. Have you then power against death? Are you superhuman? Are you an angel? And the young man, who had never shrunk from danger, shrank before Monte Cristo with indescribable terror. But Monte Cristo looked at him with so melancholy and sweet a smile that Maximilian felt the tears filling his eyes. I can do much for you, my friend, replied the Count. Go. I must be alone. Morrel, subdued by the extraordinary ascendancy Monte Cristo exercised over everything around him, did not endeavor to resist it. He pressed the Count's hand and left. He stopped one moment at the door for Battistin, whom he saw in the Rue Matignon, and who was running. Meanwhile, Fifon and d'Avrigny had made all possible haste. Valentine had not revived from her fainting fit on their arrival, and the doctor examined the invalid with all the care the circumstances demanded, and with an interest which the knowledge of the secret doubled. Fifon, closely watching his countenance and his lips, waited the result of the examination. Noirtier, paler even than the young girl, more eager than even Vifor for the decision, was watching also intently and affectionately. At last, d'Avrigny slowly uttered these words. She is still alive.
Still, cried Vifor. Oh, doctor, what a dreadful word is that.
Yes, said the physician. I repeat it, she is still alive, and I am astonished at it.
But is she safe? Asked the father.
Yes, since she lives. At that moment d'Avrigny's glance met Noirtier's eye. It glistened with such extraordinary joy, so rich and full of thought, that the physician was struck. He placed the young girl again on the chair. Her lips were scarcely discernible, they were so pale and white, as well as her whole face, and remained motionless, looking at Noirtier, who appeared to anticipate and commend all he did.
"Sir," said d'Avrigny to Vifor, "call Mademoiselle Valentine's maid, if you please."
Vifor went himself to find her, and d'Avrigny approached Noirtier.
"Have you something to tell me?" asked he.
The old man winked his eye expressively, which we may remember was his only way of expressing his approval.
"Privately?"
"Yes," said Noirtier.
"Well, I will remain with you."
At this moment Vifor returned, followed by the lady's maid, and after her came Madame de Vifor.
"What is the matter, then, with this dear child? She has just left me, and she complained of feeling unwell, but I did not think seriously of it."
The young woman, with tears in her eyes and every mark of affection of a true mother, approached Valentine and took her hand. D'Avrigny continued to look at Noirtier. He saw the eyes of the old man dilate and become round, his cheeks turn pale and tremble, the perspiration stood in drops upon his forehead.
"Ah," said he, involuntarily following Noirtier's eyes, which were fixed on Madame de Villefort, who repeated, "This poor child would be better in bed. Come, Fanny, we will put her in."
Monsieur d'Avrigny, who saw that would be a means of his remaining alone with Noirtier, expressed his opinion that it was the